Okay, good morning. I'm rather intrigued by the whole idea of winter solstice. I always have been. What intrigues me about it is, I think it was on Thursday, the 21st. What kind of pulls me towards it is this idea of the longest night of the year for us in the Western Hemisphere, and this notion of witness, that there is this way in which being present for, although most of us are asleep, me included, being present for the suffering, this, and the transformation. And that the solstices, particularly winter solstice, is this time of renewal, because it's a transition time from that longest time, the longest night, to the day. So we have a lot of holidays around this. And they are holidays, right? Most of them are celebratory. Jesus supposedly was born right around this time. And for us, December 7th is Buddha's Enlightenment Day, so Buddha was enlightened. I'm not as familiar with the Christian story about Jesus being born, but in the Buddhist story, there is this way in which, you know, the Buddha sits under the Bodhi tree all night long. And during the course of that whole process of several things happening for him, he awakens to, I would say what he understood was this deep interconnection, this deep wellspring of a healthy way in which truly understanding our solidarity with each other, how we nourish each other. And when I say each other, I don't mean just people, the whole world. That in this way that is very wholesome and life-affirming, even in the midst of death, there is this deep affirmation of life. And I think and out of that arose compassion, right? Out of that arises compassion in the midst of all the complexities and difficulties and darkness that we may experience, this kind of solidarity that we have in our life, this solidarity of knowing we're all in this together and being able to enact that. I think that's the deepest thing. And out of that, like one of the things about the Buddha is that Shakyamuni Buddha, rather than the historical Buddha, but the Buddha that is called the Sanghogakaya Buddha, this Buddha has a really long tongue that can be rolled out. But what that symbolizes is that when he gives, or he or she or this entity gives the sermon, that everyone, every being, everything can understand. That everyone, every being, and everything is transformed through this understanding. At the end of a Buddha Sutra, they always list all the beings and people who are present who've become enlightened. So that's kind of one of the hallmarks of a Buddha Sutra. So, to me, this is tied up in this witnessing, this presencing, this process of our lives. And this process includes this long night. This process includes this negotiation, if you will, this transformation of, and this witnessing of, for ourselves and others, of the transformational quality of completely being present for this long night. And in Christianity, they talk about the dark night of the soul. And in Buddhism, we say great doubt, this way in which we really deeply enter into the difficulties of our life. We enter into the difficulties using the practice as a guide for how to negotiate, understand, question what our life is about, what our life force is about. So Dogen says, Anuji says, you have doubts, but you don't have doubts that bring you to the present moment. You don't have doubts that will bring you to the present moment. So these doubts in the present moment are, we say in Buddhism, in Zen, you know, what is it? What is it? What is this? The answer to that question, by the way, is what is it? This what, this questioning of what is happening right now? And we use our understanding of how the world operates from a Buddhist perspective to answer that question, to deeply go into that, the nature of that. Dogen says, why does he say the present doubt? He says the present doubt because often the doubts we have are not about what's actually happening. The doubts we have are about ideas we have about how we would like things to be. Or doubts are about things that maybe are not so relevant. And the things that are actually are relevant, we're not paying much attention to. In his case, he's talking about Uji or being time in that particular quote. He's saying, you have doubts about the time. You have doubts about time. You think you know time. You think you know time being. You think you know the nature of this moment of your life. You think you know what it's about. But the actual question, the real question you should be asking, is the present doubt. Is what is my life in this moment without the preconceived ideas, without all the things that we think should be happening or we want to happen in a certain way. But what is our life? Can I actually meet my life in this moment and have that be okay? That's what we do in Zazen. In Zazen, we sit, and in a way, like this thing that is so compelling me, this notion of witnessing this longest night. In Zazen, we sit and we witness in a way. We witness our life. We witness our thoughts. We witness our pain. We witness our happiness. And then in the next moment, something else happens. And we're there with that something else. Shohaku Okamura, I was just reading this little book called Soto Zen. That was put out by the Soto Shu a while ago, I think maybe in the 80s. Anyway, Shohaku Okamura wrote the introduction. He wrote about Zazen in it. He says in there, Zazen is repentance, which I had not thought of before. Zazen is this way in which we let go of, we witness and let go of our thoughts. That repentance is this kind of atonement in Buddhism that I don't think has to include beating yourself up. It's not about punishment. It's about a way in which we acknowledge and see the mistakes, acknowledge and see the true nature of who we are as human beings, foolish human beings. Atone for that in the sense of saying, yes, I see that. I have doubts about that. But the doubts that we have about that, we want them to be doubts that nourish us. We want them to be doubts that are transformative for us in a positive way. So that atonement needs to be something that is a transformative positive. And yet, before we might come to that place, we still might experience this darkness, experience being lost in this long night. We may experience sitting Zazen and saying, oh, I can't do this because people say this all the time to me. I'll go somewhere and they don't practice Buddhism and they'll say, the first thing they'll say is, oh, I can't meditate. And the reason they can't meditate is because they have thoughts. Sad but true. Because people have this notion, which might be is true in some meditative traditions, but not in ours. People have this notion that the idea about that their idea about meditation is that you're not supposed to have any thoughts. It's pretty tough. Uchiyama Roshi says our mind is like thoughts are like secretions. They're like an organic event that is happening, you know. So in our tradition, as Suzuki Roshi so put it so well, you don't invite your thoughts to tea. So we are there, we are witnessing these mental secretions. We are sitting there going, I can't meditate, I can't meditate. And then you discover that, I don't know, 5 minutes later you're thinking about something totally different, or not thinking at all, or whatever it is. But yes, thoughts arise. So they're not a hindrance. They're not a problem. They're only a problem when we make them a problem. That's an example of the kind of things doubting the wrong thing. So the deepest question has more to do with this willingness to actually be present for our lives, this willingness to really settle into. So I think about winter solstice as this way in which on that particular night we settle into our lives. We settle into the earth. We settle into this long, quiet time. And I imagine throughout time and space what also occurs for me is I think about, in my case, I think about being in Tassajara in the winter during the practice period. I think about being cold. I think about the beauty of the stars, the beauty of being outside. Because most, I don't know about you, but I don't spend a lot of time outside, particularly at night. Although I love it when I get up every morning and go and get the paper and it's still dark. And in our house, you can see all these stars. You see Orion. I love Orion. When I was Shiso at Tassajara, every morning I would get up, I don't know, 4:30. My job was to ring the wake-up bell to wake everybody else up. And I would look over towards the hill cabins, and there would be Orion. He was always there. Go, hi, good morning, Orion. Let's go. Let's do this thing together. Go on and start ringing the bell. So now I get up in the morning and get the paper, and there's Orion. So I associate this with a kind of ancestry of being a human being, an ancestry of being in this world, being grounded in this world, the ancestry of the lineage of all being nurturing and supporting itself, all being going through the issues and problems of our lives, of its life, their life, and that we are doing this together. So that leads me to this morning thinking about another archetypal system, if you will, is Joseph Campbell talking about what he calls the hero's journey. So here, this is his kind of stages of how we come about or how we ask these questions of what is it? What is our life? What is it about? So he offers this as a kind of stages starting here, ending up here. But I think in actuality, our lives don't quite work that way. But maybe in some way they do. In a kind of messy way that sort of bleeds out on the edges way. So this is a story about us, right? We are the protagonists of our own life. You know, the definition of a protagonist is this, when you read a play or something, you say, well, who's this play about? Well, it's about the person who changes. The protagonist inevitably is changed through the events that are foretold or that are told about in a play. And if you read a text like Tolkien, right, Lord of the Rings, probably most of you here have read that. Those kinds of books are all about this archetypal journey. That's what it is that I think so appeals to us. Presented with this problem, the world is going to end. You know, this way in which the world is going to end, and we have to save it. And we have this fellowship. We have friends, we have people who are with us, who witness this, who go through these struggles with us. The whole world is going through this struggle with us. and how that unfolds, how that problem presents itself to us. So in the hero's journey, the first thing that Campbell points out is that we realize something is missing in our lives. I think this is particularly true of us when we're in our teens and 20s in particular. We feel this deep sense that there must be something bigger going on. There must be something deeper and more profound going on than we are aware of. And so we feel this deep, almost body sense, this deep desire to answer that question. And I don't know that that ever goes away, that we're still always seeking. Isn't that part of what our lives are about, that enrich our lives, is this way in which we are always trying to seek for and find and understand more deeply the experience that we're having. And so part of this path in Buddhism or whatever the religion is or no religion, but this path that we follow is answering those questions, is finding some deep connection that feeds our desire to understand, to make meaning of our world, and to have that meaning be a meaning that feels big in a way, that feels like it's something bigger than ourselves, to feel like we're doing something that makes a difference in some way. And so we grapple with that. Someone said to me on Sunday at San Francisco Zen Center, she's a person who's involved in the running of San Francisco Zen Center, and she was saying, here I am in the midst of this religious center, one of the biggest Zen centers in the United States. Here I am, and I don't feel like I'm doing enough. You know, I look at us and I say, we're kind of caught in a rut. We're doing this, and we're doing this, and we're doing this, but it just doesn't seem like we're really doing enough. Isn't that something we ask ourselves? In a way, it's, to me, that question in some way is like, I think too much in Zazen. And the connection for me is that somehow our life as it is right now doesn't feel like enough. And part of the reason it doesn't feel like enough is because we have these ideas about how it should be something different. We should be going out and participating in Doctors Without Borders, right? We should be in Syria. We should be completely fixing the homeless problem in Santa Cruz. We should be doing something like that. So we don't give credence to, and we don't really validate our life as it is right now. The difference we make with our coworkers, the difference we make in our families, the difference we make in the way we are in the world, just as we are in this moment, this present doubt, not some other idea about it. Now, what I said to this friend, student, was, look at this and ask yourself, first, look at what you're doing and recognize that what you're doing is important and valid, and ask yourself, is this actually my life, or is my life going and doing something else? Because it might be that your life is to go and do something else. And it might be that it's all right that your life is just as it is right now. But unless we're willing to look at our life just as it is right now and validate that and look at that and say, you know what, my life as it is, maybe I say it's a small little life, but actually it's not. None of us have small lives. Every one of us is involved in this interconnection, this vast energy, this reciprocity of the totality of this world. So every one of us, everything that we're doing makes a difference. It might be that what makes you happiest in your life might be that you do want to go to Syria. It might be that you do want to engage in Doctors Without Borders. It might be that you do want to directly engage with the issues about homelessness in Santa Cruz. So I'm not negating any of those kinds of activities, but I'm saying we have to start here and look at our own lives as it is right now and validate our own lives and our own effort. And the reason that's like people say I can't meditate because I'm thinking is because it's an idea. about what we should be doing. It's not a really sitting down for that longest night of the year and witnessing our life and asking ourselves, what is my life right now, just as it is? What is the Bodhisattva path right now, just as it is? And realizing that we all have this place and time in which we fit into this vast mandala called life. And that we acknowledge that mandala. We acknowledge our place in that. And it might be that we want to be in a different place, and there's nothing wrong with that. But at the same time, we have to look at the place that we are right now and acknowledge that. So this way in which Campbell says something is missing. So that koan, what is it? What is it? Is something missing or not? And to deeply look at that. And in order to do that, he says the next phase is that you have to leave the old. You have to let go of the old. I think from a Buddhist perspective, this letting go of the old is in a way what Chohaku is talking about. You just let go of the thoughts. You let go of the idea about what it should be. You let go of the story and just actually immerse yourself in your life just as it is. That's what we do. Zazen is a very pure form of that. The purity is not in somehow transcending your life. The purity is this willingness to sit in your life just as it is and look at that and acknowledge that if something needs to change to see that. That's the purity of our practice. It's not some idea that we have about some notion of everything being perfect. Because inevitably, everything being perfect usually has to do with, again, our ideas about what that means. Well, I'm never going to be unhappy. I'm never going to say anything stupid. I'm never going to cause any conflict. Everybody's going to like me. It's stuff like that. And in a way, that's very superficial, right? Because our lives are more complicated. They're more messy. They're more interactive. They're richer, right? That's not a very rich life in a way. You say, oh, I'm perfect. Everybody loves me. I never get in any kind of conflict. I never have any problems. I always say exactly the right thing. You know, that in a way, it's like it's not going to happen that way. And those are those ideas that we have about our lives, about what we are looking for, what we want our life to be. That I would suggest what we're looking for is something more about this deep connection. A deep connection with other people, a deep connection with the earth, a deep connection with our lives just as they are right now. This deep way of just settling into it. But that settling in includes the thoughts. The settling in includes the pain. The settling in includes all the multiplicity, the complexity of this interactive event called our life. Our life interacting with the totality of the world itself. And so that we are willing to sit for that. We're willing to be present for that. We're willing to have thoughts. We're willing to let go of thoughts. We're willing to be witness. We're willing to be the active principle. We're willing to be the protagonist. We're willing to be the helper. We're willing to be whatever it is that moment seems to ask of us that we're willing to do. I mean, that's no self. No inherently existing self. That's all no self means. That we are not inherently existing. We are, you know, like John Donne said, no man is an island. You know, how does that go? Ask not for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. This, when he says it tolls for thee, it means, as we also say in Zen, it's not somebody else and it's not you. Right? It's not somebody else, and it's not you. This way in which we are a separate individual in the sense that we are who we are. We have personalities. We have physical separation from the rest of our world. When we run into a chair, we know we've run into a chair. We don't go through the chair, and the chair doesn't go through us. And yet, simultaneously, we and the chair are one. We are not separate in a certain way. We are occupying. We are part of the totality of the mandala of that room that we're in, this life that we're living. So we are not just one, but we are also not other as well. Both of those things are happening simultaneously. So in a way, we leave the old and we can't leave the old, right? So this way in which we are willing to let go of, to experiment, to be present for, to drop these ideas that we have. And that's so hard to do. It's really hard to do. Most of the time, we're just pushed into it. We can't help it. We're pushed into change. We're lying on the floor, our tongues are hanging out. Finally, we go, "Uncle, Uncle, I'll do it. I don't want to do it, but I'll do it because I don't have any choice." And so then transformation happens. Sometimes we go into transformation, we're just like totally happy. You know, we can see, because we partly, I think, because we think we can see what that is. We can see some future that makes us very excited. So that's great. But sometimes we can't, we don't see what the future is. We don't know what it is. We want to cling to the old ways. We want to cling to these ideas we have. But whatever it is, in order for this transformation to happen, we have to let go. Remember how Tarzan swings through the jungle? You know, he's holding on to his vine. Ooh, you know, and Tarzan goes, he's going and going and going. And then there's, remember the cartoon George of the Jungle? Tarzan doesn't let, George never lets go of the rope. So George's like going through the rope and he runs into the trees, you know, because he doesn't let go of the rope. Tarzan's pretty good though at swinging, so he always swings and he lets grab the next vine and away he goes right through the jungle. Whoa, there goes Tarzan through the jungle. So in that moment of letting go of the rope, there's that moment of he's out there suspended in space. Like, what if he misses the next rope? We're worried about that. What if we miss the next rope? So we're hanging on and hanging on to this rope and either smack into a tree, or if there's not a tree there, the rope kind of just goes back and forth and we swing back and forth, and then suddenly there we are at a standstill holding on to the rope. I've still got the rope. I've still got the rope. And we're just dead in the jungle holding on to our rope. So we have to leave the old. We have to grab onto the next vine. You know, and sometimes grabbing onto the next vine means we miss the vine or we smack into the tree. Or sometimes we grab onto the next vine and it's just glorious. It's just glorious as we go through space and time holding onto our vine that moment before we have to let go and go to the next vine. And then the next step is we experiment. So this is that aspect of, at best case scenario, we're playful, right? Best case scenario is like, wow, this is kind of fun. This is something different. We say, I'm curious about it. I'm curious about my life. I'm curious about what's happening. That's hard too, because we're scared. And when you're frightened, you don't feel real curious. When you're frightened, you got white knuckles on the rope. And when change happens, sometimes it's really scary. You don't know what's going to happen. But of course, that's where the transformation happens. And so can we look at this as a grand experiment, a grand adventure? It could be that this is the only life, right? This is the only life. It could be that this is the only mind, this gift of consciousness. We have an amazing gift, this self-awareness. Also, sometimes it feels like a curse. But this amazing gift of self-awareness, to be able to define the nature of our experience, to feel like we can change our lives in certain ways. We can. We have this rich vocabulary that we're able to share with each other and communicate. That's an amazing thing that we can engage in. And yet, also, it's just filled with angst sometimes. It's filled with difficulties. It's filled with thoughts. Those pesky little secretions that keep us from our perfect meditational experience. Those pesky excretions that keep us from our perfect life. Those interactions with other people who get in our way. You know, my life would be perfect if no one else was on the freeway with me. Guess what? It doesn't work that way. And actually, if it did work that way, we wouldn't be here, because there would be no life. There would be this whole interactive event called the universe, life, this great, mysterious, wonderful, interactive, interpenetrating mandala called our life, includes all those pesky people on the freeway. It includes all those pesky thoughts. It includes all those problems. So, as much as we can conjure up curiosity about our life, as much as we can conjure up a sense of humor about our life, as much as we can lighten up and make space for our life, make space for being present for our lives. That's another thing about meditation and doing practice, about going out before the sun comes up and looking at the stars, about that longest night, is making space, reading a murder mystery or whatever it is that you do, going out to the ocean or going to the movies, that we make this space for ourselves. We make this place for us to be curious, to heal, to be able to integrate our life. So this is this way in which we experience. We make mistakes. We are curious. We witness. It's okay. It's okay. And we presence for each other, you know, that we realize that we're all in this together. And in order to do that, we have to face our own demons. That's another part of this path that Joseph Campbell talks about, which is really true, right? That's that dark night of the soul. We have to face our own demons. We have to face the part of ourselves that says, oh, you're terrible. You made this mistake. However that inner voice is that we have that talks to ourselves about what failures we are as human beings, what failures we are in our practice, how we mess things up all the time. Whatever that story is, whatever those regrets are, all of those things, you know, these are facing our own demons. But if we can maintain that level of realizing that we're not the only ones, realizing that as human beings we all go through this, realizing that if we have empathy for others, we can have empathy for ourselves, that empathy for ourselves allows us to have empathy for the other person. Empathy, compassion means in English, passion with, this way in which we are able to realize and be with, to be empathic with the other person. This doesn't mean that we become merged and no longer functional because we're so caught up in this kind of idiot compassion, as Trungpa like to call it, but this way in which we really can understand that this is the nature of what it is to be a human being, to make mistakes, to feel bad about it, and know. It's always interesting when people are honest with each other and you find out, oh, that person that you thought never had those problems has the same problem you've got. But we don't normally talk about it. So we think we're the only one. Like in the Peanuts cartoon with Pigpen, right? He's walking around with all that dust and stuff around his head. Well, we're all pigpen. Right? We've all got a constellation of stuff that we're dragging around with us. And of course, we're all Linus, right? We're all like, their little blanket. And, you know, we're like, where is my little blanket today? I need it, you know? All the characters, of course. And that's why Peanuts was such an powerful thing, because we all feel like Charlie Brown. And sometimes we're all Lucy. And then don't you love the parents? The parents, the way you hear the parents is like, up there. And you never see them. They're just like, that's kind of like those internal voices that we've got that we can't actually see or put our finger on, but they're really pressing hard, you know? So, just to really have a kind of patience and curiosity about that, a willingness to be present for your life, and to realize that we all share this with each other. And out of that, as we work with that, as we become confident in ourselves and have faith, we say, you know, we have all our Buddha nature. This teaching about Buddha nature, that we are all absolutely vital, intrinsically important to the worlding of the world, that we are, by our very nature, not separate. By our very nature, we are part of the totality of the wholeness. Not just part of it, but an integral aspect of it. Dogen says, when we are born, the whole world is born at the same time. That doesn't mean the world didn't exist before we were born, and it doesn't mean the world won't exist after we die. But it is this way in which we are welcome. We have never not been part of this family. We have never not been part of the change of the aspect of the totality of this mandala called life itself, this universal event or process that we are part of and that all beings are part of. To have faith in that. So it means that in the midst of all of our problems, in the midst of our birth and death, in the midst of beginningless time, endless time and being time, that we have never in some way not been present for this. And yet at the same time, we have our own issues and problems that are painful and hurt and that are difficult. We live in bodies. At the same time, that's happening. But as we remember that in a real grounding way, not in a way that takes us away from the ground of our life, not in some way that's a fantasy that separates us from our life, but in this developing this kind of confidence, this kind of faith in this, that we are not separate from this, that somehow we can negotiate this, that somehow we can do this thing called our life. We find this kind of confidence, and in this confidence we find our own truth, right? We find out about who we are. We find our wisdom. Every one of us has our wisdom. Every one of us is able to respond skillfully. Every one of us, the very life experiences that we have, the things that are painful, that's the source of our wisdom. So these problems that we have, the difficulties that we go through, these are the very building blocks of our wisdom. This is how we find our own truth. This is how we negotiate and we mature. And then finally, we come back. And this I think is something that in this kind of model that Joseph Campbell's talking about, or when we talk about this from an archetypal point of view, it's sort of like this is the only time, right? But this, so in the Zen we say returning to the marketplace. So we've gone through this this internal process, this presencing, this long night, this winter solstice, this dark night of the soul. which again doesn't just happen once, but it happens often, right, in our lives. But I would suggest that this process is not, it's not like this, it's not linear. It maybe it's more like a spiral. You know, we hit these places, but as we hit them and go through these processes in different ways, we become wiser, more compassionate, more skillful. And when the Buddha was enlightened on that faithful winter solstice, the morning when he saw the morning star or Venus in the sky, his response was to become a solitary religious person, to kind of go off into the wilderness, because he thought, what I have understood is so difficult to understand that I can't teach this. Nobody else can understand this teaching. So the Lord Brahma, one of the Indian gods, came down and he said, you know, you can't do this. You can't, like, just take this wisdom that you have now and just disappear. So the Buddha actually went, and for, I think it was for like 7 days, he went around and meditated and did various things. And then Brahman came and said, you know, you really have to teach. You really have to come back. And we say, in Zen we say, return to the marketplace. So there's this way in which we are going inward and going outward, going inward and going outward. And we do that all the time. Just in that moment when you're standing in your kitchen and suddenly you have this thought, you have this epiphany about an insight. Are you just in a moment that something comes to you? And then the next moment, you're doing something else. The next moment. So this way in which we actually go through this process, back and forth, over and over again, and it keeps building on itself, building on itself. And sometimes you don't even remember. You've had that experience, right, where you go, what was that? That was great. I can't remember it, you know. But it deeply affects your psyche and your mind, your body, your relationships. So we come back. I think parenting is like this. Parents are in the business of bringing back the wisdom of their life and sharing it with their kids. All of us are in this business of supporting each other, bringing our wisdom to each other. All of us are doing this. All of us are bringing our maturity as co-workers and bosses and parents and friends, drivers, shoppers. You know, wherever we are, we're engaged in this activity. This is the bodhisattva activity. Dogen talks about, in the fast going teaching right now called Kuge, he talks about the blue lotus. The blue lotus blooms in fire. And fire is samsara. So we've all heard about the lotus in muddy water, right? The lotus that is sustained and blooms in muddy water. Well, another lotus is the blue lotus that is sustained and blooms in fire. This is that bodhisattva path. This path in which, this is true for all of us. We are all in muddy water. We are all in the fire. We are all living our lives in the midst of the messiness and the difficulties and the problems and the joys and the happiness. All of those things are happening. Sometimes simultaneously, sometimes separately, but that's all part of the mix. So it's complicated. Our lives are complicated. Being a human being is complicated. And we complicate it even more by having certain ideas about it that make it come more complicated because we don't, it doesn't fit our idea of how it should be. So we say, what is it? What is it to say that I live this life as Buddha in the midst of samsara? What is that about? This Buddha that makes mistakes, this Buddha that sometimes absolutely, completely hits the mark. Dogen says we shoot 100 arrows at the target and we miss a lot. We also hit the target too. You know, I always say when I hear that thing, he said, you know, you He says in this little bit about this, he says, you shoot 100 arrows, you know, you hit the target. We always think, oh, you must have hit the target on the 100th arrow. Maybe you hit the target on the 5th arrow. You know? Maybe you hit it on the 5th, the 77th, and the 89th time. Because we actually hit the target a lot. We hit the target a lot. So, this is what I think about when I'm thinking about the solstice. This is what I'm thinking about right now, this time of the year, for me. Next week I'll be thinking about something else. This afternoon we're going to go see the new Star Wars movie, so I'll be thinking about something totally different. But this sustains me. This thinking about my life this way, I find very sustaining and affirming. That in the midst of all of my own mistakes and my difficulties, in the midst of this presencing, trying to be present for the difficulties of other people, the witnessing and just remembering and opening my heart to the difficulties of all beings in the darkest, longest day of the night of the year, that willingness to just entertain the presencing of that for each other, doing that for each other, in the midst of my own personality, my own difficulties, my own desire sometimes not to want to relate at all to any of you, you know, and loving you at the same time, right? We all have those conflicting feelings that we go through. Who are we? Who are we? How do I negotiate this? How do I, as the best I can, do this bodhisattva practice? So that's what I'm thinking about right now. Thank you very much.